Shalom, this is Bendo Jones, continuing with a study in rabbinic hermeneutics and how the Jews interpret their Bible, applied today to a question directed toward the riddle of the rejection. Rejected king or rejected kingdom. This is to say, and to pose the question, did the Jews reject Jesus, or did Jesus reject the Jews? Did Israel reject Jesus as their messianic king, or did Jesus reject Israel as a messianic kingdom? I think that if we take the inversion of this question, it's very important. And according to rabbinic hermeneutics, it is imperative that we invert this as all other questions. I realize today that all of us have been taught from the time we were children in our Sunday schools, as we grew older in reading books and commentaries, the thought in vogue is that the Jews rejected Jesus as their king, that Israel rejected Jesus as their Messiah, and as a result of this rejection, that Jesus turned to the Gentiles. Others will not insist that Jesus did so, but that after the death, burial, and resurrection, Israel continued to reject that, and finally the apostles turned to the Gentiles as sort of a second choice of God as concerning why Jesus came. Now, this concept of the rejection of Jesus as the king and of the Jews and the king of Israel is the very heart of replacement theology that we have spoken of. And it is the heartbeat of crisis theology. That is to say that the replacement theologian who says that the New Testament replaced the Old Testament, Christianity replaced Judaism, the kingdom of heaven, in other words, Rome, replaced the earthly kingdom of Israel, and that the kingdom was spiritualized by the apostles, this replacement idea finds its basic roots in the concept that Israel rejected Jesus as their Messiah, and that the Jews rejected him and continue to reject him as their Lord. Now, in inverting this question today, I would like for us to think just a moment about the illogical position of replacement theology and crisis theology with regard to this tenet. Isn't it rather ridiculous to think that God had plan A that he was going to do, but because of the failure of Israel to see this plan, he came up with plan B, another plan of salvation? And this is basically what replacement theology and crisis theology teaches, that God had to do a second choice, rather because of the Jews' rejection of Jesus and the rejection of Israel as him as their king. Now, today we are going to deal with text, and I am the first one to concede that if we read the commentaries today, certainly they most all agree to this position. A greater part of them do. If we look at the questions of the day from the standpoint of simple translations, we would have to agree that the Bible makes such statements. But today we're going to analyze these texts and see what they really say, and to ask ourselves and put these texts through some hermeneutical analyses. There are some 23 references in the book of John alone that seem to decry the Jew and the people of Israel for the quote-unquote rejection of Jesus. Many years ago, after I had finished seminary and I had been thoroughly indoctrinated in this rejection syndrome, and I preached that rejection syndrome because I thought that was part of the gospel. But they made one big mistake. When the institutions that I attended, the theological institutions that I studied in, insisted that I study Greek, and I buried myself in the Greek language for 3 long years, after which I didn't know how to ask for a drink of water in the Greek language. I came to the conclusion that there's either something the matter with me or the system of teaching, with no reflection whatever on the professors I studied under. When I began to ask some of the classmates at the in the end of my Greek study, say, if you wanted a glass of water in Greek, how would you ask for it? And they shrugged their shoulders. Another thing I noticed, that there were all the time that we spent studying exceptions to the rules and very little time studying the rules themselves. Now, when we make an analysis of the language and we spend more time studying the exceptions than we do the rules, there must be something the matter with the approach to study. Of course, in time, as I pursued my studies in Greek and began to go to the Greeks and ask them questions, what does this mean and what is the rule, I found that the big problem was that the seminaries are using a system of analysis of Greek that's very strange. First of all, the people in the Renaissance who brought the Greek back were monks. And those monks who did this revival of the interest in Greek considered Latin the holy tongue of Jesus. In other words, the Vulgate was considered the holy tongue, and the Vulgate scriptures was exonerated above the Greek and the Hebrew. Now, in understanding or trying to understand the Greek, the monks, as they analyzed the Greek, they pushed it through a Latin sieve. That is, they tried to make a grammatic parallel between Greek and Latin, which was quite impossible. To illustrate this, in Latin you have 8 cases of the noun. In Greek you only have 4 cases of the noun. So what the monks did, they split the 4 cases in the Greek and forced it through an 8-case system in the Latin. And the seminary Greek that I studied when I was in seminary took the Latin approach to studying Greek and tried to explain Greek from through English grammar, through Latin grammar, and back to Greek grammar. So you can understand the complexity of trying to get grammars to agree, which they do not necessarily have to do. But in the attempt of understanding the New Testament, we must get back to the primal Greek text, to the codex of those texts, and find out what was said. And rather than going from Latin to German to English, we need to go from Greek back to Hebrew and see what did it mean in the Hebrew text. So in that approach of study this morning, I want to take a few passages that very definitely state that the Jews rejected Jesus as their king, and I want us to look at those texts and see if that's what they really say. And I'm not going to get profound and try to get into deep Greek dissertations. I just want to take a few simple words and let you make the interpretation, which you, even if you've never studied Greek, will be able to see. Now, in the question of the rejected king and the rejected kingdom, I want to cite a few texts, but it will be impossible in this tape to cover all of the texts that deal in this question. Fairly, it will be impossible to make a hermeneutical analysis justly on this recording. So I suggest by all means that if you want a more thorough understanding of this study of the rejected king and rejected kingdom, that you study the publication that goes with this tape by the same title, The Riddle of the Rejected King or Kingdom. And in that, we make a hermeneutical analysis and test this question according to the basic Mishnaic laws of Rabbi Hillel, and we posed the seven laws of Hillel and examined the issue as it were a court case. We don't have time to do that in the tape today, but I think if you read the publication, you will appreciate the rabbinic logic that is involved in this question. So today we want to deal with a few texts and pose a few questions, not necessarily answers, but a few questions regarding the issue, did Israel reject Jesus as their king, or did Jesus reject Israel as his kingdom? Did you ever think of inverting that question? We're going to invert it in our study on this tape and in the publication. But first of all, let's get some standard texts that indicate that the Jews rejected Jesus as their king. The first text that I would like to deal with is in the first chapter of the book of John and the 11th verse. Here we read, "He came unto his own, and his own received him not." Now, naturally, he came into his own what? All the commentaries point out he came to his own people, he came to his own nation, and his own people rejected him. Now, I want to point here how that we see a good illustration of extreme bias on the part of the translators, and we must understand that the translators were anxious to impart their theology into the translation. When I was studying Greek, our Greek professor said that our theology would determine how we translated certain words. I found it difficult to accept this. If we understand a word in one language, and there is a word in another language that means the same thing, why would it be so difficult? Day-day. And day-day, which would be literally translate, yom-yom, day-day, means in Hebrew, every day. But in English, it doesn't. So in English, we have to say every day to translate yom-yom in Hebrew properly. You see, so it's not always the literal translation that transfers the literal thought. But here in John 1:11, and the verses following, we see one of the most clear-cut examples of a overt mistranslation to get across one's theology. I believe a translation could be done, and if any translation is done scientifically, it doesn't make any difference whether the translator is a Jew, a Christian, a Muslim. It wouldn't make any difference if he was a total atheist, if he was a linguist, and if he was translating conscientiously words and meanings of words from one language to the other, what difference would it make? Let us suppose that we have a computer. And in that computer, we feed in a language exactly for what each word is and means. And then we structure another language, and we put up corresponding factors between one language to the other language. This computer will only put out what you put in. So if we come to a word in one language, it would translate it to the other. I envision the day when we will be able to do a translation from Greek back to Hebrew and from Hebrew to English so that we can get the fullness of the meaning of the New Testament message on an unbiased, non-theological, non-prejudiced system. You see, the nice thing about working with a computer has never been baptized or circumcised, therefore it has no religious conviction. It just gives the facts. Now, if such a translation was done, we would get a pure meaning of exactly what the words are. And to the best of my ability this morning, I want to take John 1:11 in Greek, and I want to play this game with you. And I'm going to let you do the translating. I'm going to let you be the one who does the translating. In John chapter 1:11, he came unto his own, and his own received him not. Now, the American Standard Version of the Bible puts a footnote there stating that in the original this occurs in the neuter, which creates some problem in this text translation. Now what the American Standard Version is saying is that if it is occurs in the neuter gender, then it should not be translated, "He came unto his own, and his own received him not." This is all translated in the masculine gender, not in the neuter. So if we translated it in the neuter gender, it would read much different from the way it is translated, that he came unto his own, and his own received him not. Here, in this text, I want to quote to you from the Greek exactly what it says, and then let you help me make a translation. In the Greek language, this verse reads, and I'm going to break it in half, "He came into his own, and then, and his own received him not." The phrase, "He came unto his own," in Greek is "ista idea aletheia." Ista idea aletheia. Is means into, ta the, idea, the neuter form of a Greek word, auton, his own. In other words, or he came. Ista idea aletheia, he came unto what? The word aletheia, he came. But what is the word ista idea, that phrase, what does it mean? Is into, ta is the, and the word idea in Greek is what we're concerned with. Does the word idea mean his own people? Does it mean his own nation? Or what does it mean? Now, I would like to ask you a question. Think about the sound of this sentence, or this phrase. Ista idea aletheia. Aletheia, he came, ista into thee. Now, the word that we have left is the one little word, idea. Do you have any idea what the Greek word idea means? You hear it? Do you have any idea of what the Greek word idea really means? The same word, idea, in Greek is the word identical to idea. We get our word idea from the Greek word idea. So it says here, into the idea he came. Into the idea. What does it mean, the idea? Well, you see, when we understand the Hebraic background of this chapter, the word in this context, idea, refers back to verse 1, "In the beginning was the Word," the Logos. Now, the word Logos in the usage of that day was the same word for the word Torah. The word Torah was the Word. Psalms chapter 119, "Thy Word, O Lord, is forever established in the heavens." 176 verses in Psalms 119 is an acrostic starting through the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph, Beit, Gimel, and any good Bible shows you that acrostic breakdown of each section, and each section has to do with the Torah, or the Word of God. The Torah, "Thy Torah is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto thy ways. By thy Torah thou created the heavens and the earth." By the Torah, all these word, and the same is in John chapter 1 and verse 1. "In the beginning was the Torah, and the Torah was before God." That is, the Torah existed before God existed. That sounds strange, doesn't it? But you see, the Torah, the God, is the word for creator. And something had to exist before creator. You cannot have a creation without a creator. Nor can you have a creator without a creation. God as creator did not exist as creator until creation. Before creation, he was the Ein Sof, the incomprehensible, principle one. And this idea, this essence that existed and pre-existed before the creation of the world, the incomprehensible one, as creatures within the creation, you and I can only comprehend what God was by creation. When I behold the heavens, the works of thy hands, the moon and the stars which thou hast created, what is man that you are mindful of him? You see the psalmist there spreading his thoughts to the outermost part of heaven, still could not stretch his mind beyond creation. As creatures within creation, we are subject to creation and the limits of creation to understand what God is. As a creature in creation, I can only understand God through creation, as the creator. But I know that before the creation, there was an existence, and that essence that existed before the creation was the idea. If you will look up the word idea in the dictionary, you will find that the Greek word idea simply meant the true existence of heavenly things, after which the natural universe or the material universe was created as models. That is, the concept of idea means that the real thing is the heavenly, and the earth, the material world, is only models of what is in the idea. So in the idea, before the creator, God conceived and wrought all these things. And this Torah, by the Torah he created the heavens and the earth, pre-existed the creator, because the Torah is forever established in the heavens. According to Judaism, God created the world by the Torah. All things were made by him, the Torah, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him, the Torah was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light of Torah shined out of darkness. In the Zohar, it says there's four kinds of light. There's the kind of light of a candle. There's the kind of light of the sun. The light of the sun, and outside of that is the light of the universe. In other words, beginning, first of all, that the light of a candle gets its light from plants and animals. Plants and animals get their light from the sun. And the sun is something out there that God put there that can drink in the light of the Torah, the eternal light, and that the sun eats and drinks in this eternal light, and that the sun excretes its light to the earth, so that the sun is a great generator that eats the light of the Torah. The highest form of light is the Torah. And the light that shineth out of darkness, and the darkness comprehended or apprehended it not. In the Psalms it said he created the light and formed the darkness. You see, darkness was here all the time, because darkness is the absence of light. But in the creation, as the tongues of the Torah twisted themselves through the universe, it created he created the light, and the light in turn formed and gave dimension to the darkness. That is in John chapter 1 and verse 3. In him the Torah was life. All life was made by the Torah, and this life was the light of men. The light of Torah shined out of darkness, and the darkness could not apprehend, comprehend, or change it. Darkness cannot change light. Light changes darkness. He created the light, and the light formed the darkness. And then it goes into the story about John the Baptist, who came to be a witness of the light of Torah. In verse 9, this is the true light, the light of Torah that came into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made by him, but the world knew him not. This is exactly what Judaism says about the Torah. And then in verse 14, get this, only in verse 14, it says, and the Torah became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory as the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Now, this Torah is the idea. The idea that pre-existed creation, that became creator, that gave light and life to man and to the world, and this Torah became flesh and dwelt among us. This we illustrated in the tape on the riddle of the sequence of events, how that Jesus in his life actually wound up in his life the essence of the Torah in 3.5 years, and how that in 33.5 years, in the riddle of the Messiah, he completely wrapped up in himself the essence of the history of Israel. Now, what is the idea? What is the idea? The idea is that eternal essence that existed before creation. And that Torah, which brought all things into existence, was made flesh and dwelt among us. Jesus was the personification of the Torah of Israel. He wrapped up in himself the essence of the Torah so that the Gentiles could have access to him, to God, through Jesus Christ in his fulfilling the law for us. Now here, he came unto his own, and his own received him not. It's not talking about he came to the Jews, and the Jews rejected him. Ista idea aleithin. Into the idea he came. The idea of Torah. He personified the Torah. He came and dwelt. The word in Hebrew for dwelt is or dwelling is shakun. An apartment in Israel is called shakun, a dwelling. Mishkan, tabernacling among us. He came dwelling. He came mishkan, tabernacling among us. The word mishkan is the word for the tabernacle, or the dwelling tent of God with Israel. Hear it? Shakun, shakan, he dwelt. Shakun, a dwelling. Mishkan, a dwelling place of God with Israel, was the mishkan, the tabernacle. And he, Mishkan, tabernacled among us, and we beheld his glory. The word glory in Hebrew is Shekinah. The Shekinah. Hear it? Shakan, he dwelt. Shakun, a dwelling. Mishkan, a tabernacle. And Shekinah. The Shekinah, the root of the Shekinah glory, the Shekinah, comes from the dwelling presence of God. And he dwelt among us. And we beheld tabernacling, Mishkan, and we beheld his glory, Shekinah. You see how you've got to get back into the Hebrew to understand the beautiful relationships between what we mean. It's so much greater than the concept, the Greek concept of simple incarnation. That is baby stuff. That is Greek mythology. But the concept that he into this idea, Ista idea, he came into the idea of the pre-existing Torah, and he dwelt among us, tabernacling. And in verse 14, there's another bad mistake in the translation. In verse 13, it says, which were born not of flesh, nor of the will of man, nor of the will of he was born not of blood, nor of the will of flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. Now, if you'll notice here, it seems to be talking about those that believe on his name. But in the Greek, it's a singular verb, and rather than saying which were born, it should have been translated who was born, speaking of he that came into the idea, Jesus. Who was born not of blood, that means from the process of the menstrual cycle of a woman, not of blood of the monthly period, nor of the will of the flesh. The word will there is the word lust. He was not born out of the process of the blood of a woman, nor of the passion, the lust of a man, are the lust of the flesh, the hunger, the sexual appetite, nor of the desire of a man to give birth, or desire of a man to copulate with a woman. His birth was not on that order. He was born of the lust, of the passion, of the will, of the nature of the Creator, God. You see? It's not speaking that who, which were, but who was. It's not talking about the people that believe on his name. This is going back to verse 11 when it says, each the idea, elation. He came into the idea. Into the idea he came. And the next part of that verse, ki tu idiu oton u parle bon. Each the idea elation, into the idea he came, ki tu idiu oton. He and to the neuter, idea, to idea, into the idea of him, and the idea of him, u parlevo. Now, listen to this. What is John is saying here, into the idea he came, and the idea of him, the idea of him, ou parlez-vous in Greek. The ou is negative, not. And the idea of him is not parlez-vous. Now, what is parlez-vous in Greek? The French take a word from this directly into their language, like we take the idea into ours. Parlez-vous français? Do you speak French? So the word ou parlez-vous means that the idea of him is not speakable. When you consider the idea of Torah, which is incomprehensible, and the idea became creator, and by the Torah he did all of these things of essence, out of which the creation is simply models of that. How can you comprehend the incomprehensible? Somebody said, well, if that does not mean he came into his own and his own received him not, then explain what it means when it says into the idea he came and the idea of him is not speakable. Well, the explanation to that is simply this, that it's unexplainable. It is impossible for us to comprehend the incomprehensible. It's impossible for us to speak the unspeakable. That when we try to define the essence and the idea and the Torah and the creation from nothingness to somethingness, it's impossible to do. You know, we cannot even comprehend what nothing is. Before creation, there was neither matter, energy, space, or time. Now, without those four elements, I want you to think about something in nothing. It's like John Jasper, the great black preacher in Richmond, Virginia, right after the Civil War, was preaching on that passage in Isaiah where it says, the enemies of God are nothing, yea, they are less than nothing. John Jasper read that text. And he says, now it says here that God, the enemies of God are nothing. Now we know what is nothing, because nothing is a zero. But what can be less than nothing? I'll explain it to you, said John Jasper. Nothing is a zero, and less than nothing is a zero with the rim knocked off of it. What could better express nothingness? But see, if we don't have matter, energy, space, and time, we don't have anything to relate to, and man cannot comprehend nothingness. You can't even write it, because you cannot write nothing without writing thing. No thing, and without thing you cannot define, without something you cannot define nothing, no thing. It's impossible for us to blank out of our mind totally nothing. What do you think about, son? Nothing. No one ever thought about nothing. It's impossible for anybody to comprehend nothingness. Is incomprehensible to man. We cannot erase in our mind matter, energy, space, and time and come up to think about nothing. Everything we think about is something. Even as nothing as we might think is still something. So here in this John 1:11, it doesn't say that he came into his own and his own received him not. I was recently talking to a professor friend of mine, and we were discussing the concept of the plural covenants and whether or not the Jews rejected Jesus, and he brought up this text. Now, this man had 11 years of Greek studies. He is a Greek teacher. And when we sat down and I said, well, let's get the Greek and look at it, and we went through the text, ista idea alethi, ti tu ideu opton, tu parlevon. When I went through that and I began to explain it and get him, because he was a Greek scholar and he could just give me ista means into the, and then the idea, and when we got to that, and he said, that is very difficult. He said, we all know that that is a very difficult passage to translate. I said, look, I said, what's the difficulty about it? I said, Doc, do you have any idea what the Greek word idea means? And he had such a shocked look on his face. He said, well, certainly, idea means idea. And he looked at that text and he looked up at me and he said, why hasn't somebody translated that differently? He said, none of the translations give that. I said, I know that. But the real reason that no translation gives it is because when people translate the Bible, most of them are translating it to sell it. And they don't want to translate anything that would create an issue that they couldn't sell the translation. So everybody is just saying, in another way, what has always been said before without getting back to the original. And we'll see this many, many times when we do our studies together, that people are not true to the text many times when they translate the Bible. And the unfortunate thing is that the more translations that I read that come out, and the more translations that are being done, and the more recent the translation is, the farther it becomes from the original text. As a matter of fact, today they do not apologize for saying that this is not a translation but a paraphrase, and the whole world buys it. The most accurate, Dr. David Flusser, professor at Hebrew University, a linguist that you, I don't know how many languages a man speaks and reads, but many, many languages, both ancient and modern. And Dr. Flusser said, someone asked him once, what is the best translation into English? And Dr. Flusser smiled and he said, well, it's very difficult to obtain that translation, but there is a translation of the Bible that is very good in the Hebrew scriptures. It is almost a word-for-word translation. Only a few exceptions. But it's very difficult to find this. And the person that was talking to him got out a piece of paper ready to write down this translation. And I never will forget Dr. Flusser jestingly said, it's called the King James Translation. Isn't that something? That this professor of Hebrew and New Testament in the Hebrew University points at the King James Version as the nearest to the original. Doesn't mean that it is perfectly translated, but it's nearer than anything else in the Old Testament Scripture. Now, the American Standard Version is probably closer, because we did have a lot of breakthrough between the 1881 edition and the 1901 edition of the American Standard Version with regard to the understanding the participial form of the Greek language due to the finding of the Rosetta Stone. But the American Standard Version is a better translation of the New Testament text than the King James translation. We notice that in this text, they at least acknowledge in the footnote that there's something the matter with translating John 1:14 as he came into his own and his own received him not. That is no reason. There is no excuse for translating that verse thusly. Now, another example, if I could give it to you, is in the 7th chapter of John. We find that Jesus, there is a statement here that sounds very much against the Jews and the Jewish people, because in the 7th chapter of John, in verse 1, we read, "After these things, Jesus walked no more in Galilee, for he would not walk in Jewry, because the Jews sought to kill him." Here in this verse, "After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he would walk no longer in Jewry, because the Jews sought to kill him," implies that the Jews are against Jesus. Now, any Christian that would sit down and read this with an open mind could not help but conclude that the word Jewry is speaking of Judaism, the Jewish religion, and that Jesus would not walk among the Jews, or Jewry, the Jewish people, because the Jews sought to kill him. Instead, he walked in Galilee. Now, the uninformed reader would read that, and there's no way that they could possibly read that without feeling a little animosity toward this crowd that worship in the synagogue. But in the Greek language, it comes so far from even implying that. It says he did not walk in Jewry. Should have been translated, and the same word over and over again has been translated by these very translators as, "He walked no longer in Judea, for the Judeans sought to kill him. He walked, therefore, in Galilee." Now, those people in Galilee were just as Jewish. They all went to the synagogues just like the people in Judea. So the issue here is not the question of Judaism. It's not the question of Jewry. It's not the question of the Jewish people as a whole. What John is saying here in the 7th chapter of John, it says, "After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, and he would not walk in Judea because the Judeans sought to kill him." Judea and Galilee were two different countries during the time of Jesus. There was Galilee and Samaria and Judea, three countries on the east side or the west side of the Jordan River. And these three countries were all under Roman rule. But Jesus had to get a military pass, so to speak, to travel from Galilee to Samaria to Judea. You see, it's a very critical political thing. And the issue here is an issue of geography and politics. It has nothing whatever to do with the Jewish religion, because the people in Galilee, as I said, were just as Jewish as those in Judea. So it should have been translated that after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he would not walk in Judea because the Judeans sought to kill him. You see, Jesus was kind of considered a carpetbagger down in Judea that had come down from up north to stir up a revolution. And he was a threat. You know, if you will excuse me saying so, it was damn Yankee, go home. The southern kingdom of Judea wanted no part of the revolution that was going on in Galilee. And this, all this talk about a kingdom and all that stirred words of a coup d'etat and of sedition and revolution. And the Judeans said, "We don't want it. Go back to Galilee with this." So we find that this text is entirely, has to be interpreted in the light of what the words literally mean in the Greek language. And the word does not mean Judea, Jewry, it means Judea. And certainly those people in Galilee were just as Jewish as the people in Judea. So the whole idea, you know, somebody came up with the idea that the Galilean were Christians and the Judeans were Jews, and that is totally ridiculous also. It's so strange how people will not go back into the historical background and interpret the Bible according to the actual historical meaning, rather than trying to make it mean and say something that it does not mean at all. So in the riddle of the rejection, the rejected king, and the rejected kingdom, we see several texts that could be interpreted as meaning otherwise. In the historical study of this situation, one can see quickly that where the high churches, the Greek Orthodox, the Roman Catholic, and so forth, have accused the Jews of crucifying Jesus, the Protestant Reformation never charged the Jews with that responsibility. What the Reformation did in the 15th century for the Protestant world, it took Vatican II in the 1960s to do for the Catholic world. And that is to say that what Protestantism got away from the idea of the Jews crucifying Jesus, but it took four centuries for the Catholic world to come to that position. In Vatican II, it plainly states that the Jews today are not responsible for the physical act of the crucifixion of Jesus. Now, it doesn't take anybody with much sense to know that people living today didn't live 2,000 years ago, but the spirit of Vatican II far exceeded the actual words of Vatican II. Because in the result is that the liturgy and so forth in the church has removed those statements that blame the Jews for the crucifixion. I never shall forget one minister who said back in 1960s, he says, well, they can try to take the guilt of the crucifixion from the Jews if they want to, but when you can prove to me that Herod and Pontius Pilate were not Jews, then I'll agree with that. How do you answer such stupidity? Such a crass attitude toward anyone who knows history knows that Pontius Pilate was a Roman and not a Jew, and that Herod was an Edomian and not a Jew. He was an Edomite, a descendant of Esau. So neither Herod nor Pontius Pilate were Jews. And yet a lot of people have been buying this poppycock that Herod and Pilate and all these were all Jews responsible for the crucifixion. You know, John Lawrence said ignorance can be cured, but there's no hope for stupidity. Oglethorpe pointed out that for over 200 years we have known these things, and yet the church has not accepted. Over 200 years we've known that a lot of the bias that has been translated into the scriptures, scholarship has known that it shouldn't be there, but they still keep publishing the commentaries and so forth because it fits their theological concepts. Here we find that the whole argument today, it's like one evangelical professor made a statement to me, or he made a statement, we were debating the issue of the rejected king and the rejected kingdom, and he came out with one statement. He said that the issue of the Jews crucifying Jesus is not the issue at all, but the question is that the Jews reject Jesus. He said no intelligent student of the scripture or history could accuse the Jew of any special guilt in the crucifixion. I, said the professor, am guilty of the crucifixion. If I have no guilt in it, I have no benefit from it. The guilt of the Jews was not in crucifying Jesus, but rejecting him. They rejected him as their king, and they perpetually reject him as their Lord. The Jews' condemnation is in rejecting their king, not in crucifying him. Any idiot who could read and knows that the Romans executed the mechanics of the crucifying, and any idiot that would look around today knows that the Jews still reject it. Now, this is a pretty good argument. This man is a proponent of the school of historical premillennialism, which is basically not much different from the amillennial position. But in this argument, he was posing that the Jews were guilty of rejecting Jesus. Now, I want to ask you, and I challenge this professor, I want, give me kal vachomer. I want an example. Give me a text in the Greek that can be justified to say this. Well, of course, the first thing he did was come to John 1, 12 through 14. We took care of that. He conceded on that point that it was a mistranslation. Fortunately, the man could read Greek. And so he went to the 7th chapter of John. He agreed that it was political and it was a mistranslation. And then he cited something else. And you've got to understand, this man was very much opposed to the idea of the use of the Scofield Bible. But he went to the book of Matthew, chapter 11, and in the Matthew 11, and verse 20, it has a very he had a very interesting observation to make with regarding to the Jews rejecting the kingdom of Jesus as their king, because he pointed out that that here in the 20th verse of the 11th chapter of Matthew, that then Jesus began to upbraid the cities wherein most of his mighty works were done, because they repented not. He said Jesus had presented himself by his miracles, and they had rejected him on the basis of the credential of his presenting the miracles to him. I said, now wait a minute. When I read the word then, it connects me with what is said before in this text. And he said, certainly, that's right. And I said, in the Scofield Bible, which you oppose very much, I said, it says just above that, Jesus rejected and judgment predicted. And he says, well, I don't say it because Scofield said it. I say it because it's true. I said, then show me in the preceding text who questions Jesus' messianic claim. What group of Jews are questioning why that Jesus might not be the Messiah? And when he went back and read the text from the beginning of chapter 11, you know who questioned whether or not Jesus was the Messiah? It was none other than John the Baptist and his disciples. John the Baptist and his disciples questioned, are you the one that we are looking for, or shall we wait for another? John 11 and verse, or Matthew 11, 3. It was John the Baptist and his disciples, and they are the only one in that context that questioned the rabbinic claims of, or the messianic claims of Jesus. If indeed anybody was questioning, then it was John the Baptist and his disciples. Don't blame it on the Jews. Isn't it strange that the same John who saw the Spirit descending from heaven and abiding upon him, the same John that said, this is the, heard the voice out of heaven and said, this is the Messiah, the same John that said, behold the Lamb of God, the same John the Baptist in prison now sends his disciples to Jesus, and he asked them, art thou he that should come, or do we look for another? The reason that they had doubted this, John and those disciples down in the area of the Dead Sea, the Essenes, refused to take a sacrifice to the temple because they said the temple should not be honored because the priesthood is apostate. But here, Jesus, we see, had been sending people like the lepers to the temple, and Jesus had been, according to the traditional Pharisees, and opposed to the idea of the Essenes, Jesus had been honoring the temple worship not because of the apostate priest, but because of the sacredness of the office, that it should be respected. And for this reason, John questioned. So when we come in the Scofield Bible down at the end of verse 19 of Matthew 11, where it says that Jesus rejected and predicted judgment, that is purely something that has been added in that is not stated in the text. There's nothing stated in the text about the Jews or Israel rejecting him. What they were upbraiding, he was upbraiding these cities not because they rejected, but because they repented not. Because they were not repenting, not because they were rejecting. And he said it would be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon and in the day of judgment. And Capernaum, he compared to Sodom, would be into this day if the miracles were performed there, if they had seen these things. Not a question of accepting him. It's a question of basic changing their attitude as Jews toward God and getting down to business in sincerity with what they were supposed to be as Jews. Here we find the whole question when he talks about accepting. It's always whosoever, any man, and all that. It never talks about to you Jews. It's never addressed. He's looking out, whosoever. That's a message Judaism did not have. He stretched his hand not to the house of Israel, but always pointing to the world when he said that whosoever, he's talking about the world and not about Israel. Come unto me, all of you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest in your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Is an invitation to the world, not to Israel. And that's what we've got to distinguish here, is what he's saying to Israel and what he is saying to the world. And we must keep these things very definitely separated in our minds. Now, the other classic illustration that this particular professor brought up about the Jews rejecting Jesus is in the 21st chapter of Matthew, when he makes his triumphant entry into Jerusalem. And in Matthew chapter 21, we find that Jesus, as he enters into Jerusalem, the story of the sending the disciples out, he was out at Bethpage. He sent his disciples in. They got the colt of an ass and brought it back. And the story in verse 8, it says, a very great multitude. How many is that? Now here Jesus is coming into the city, and a very great multitude of people come out to meet him. And in verse 11, when he came into the city, it says that the whole city had been moved. This great multitude out of the city of Jerusalem had gone out to meet Jesus. And when they met him, now we have to understand, if you read each of the four Gospels, they all say a little bit different about what this crowd was seeing. But as we pointed out in the study of the Talit and the Tzitzit, they were not casting their clothes down before him, but it says that they were taking their Talits, or their prayer shawls. They were holding up the prayer shawl on palm branches and making a canopy before him. And he literally rode into Jerusalem under this canopy of talit, as they were holding them up and they were singing, Hashanah Haba, Hashanah Haba, the year has come, the year has come. HaMashiach Kavo, the Messiah is here. HaMashiach Ben David, Messiah the son of David. Hoshenu, have mercy on us. Hoshenu, have mercy on us. Hoshenu, have mercy on us. Now, when they're talking in those tones, they're not talking about save us from our lost and sinful condition. But these Jews in Jerusalem, this multitude that came out of the city, were crying, Hosanna. It's Hosanna is actually Hoshenu, which means have mercy on us. Deliver us from the oppression of these Romans. Deliver us from the apostate, corrupt priest. Deliver us right now, immediately set up thy kingdom. That's what Mark said. He said they expected that the kingdom of God would be established immediately. And here they're going out, the multitude, the whole city moved with them, that he was the Messiah. Now this professor was using this as an illustration of Israel's rejection of the Messiah. I want you to show me one word in that whole context that even vaguely suggests that they were rejecting Jesus in this action. Now,
This is the end of tape number one. For the continuation of the message, put in tape number two on the Midrash of Matthew by Wendell Jones.